Music Respawn. I'm Kate Remington with Tom Salta. It's great to have a chance to talk again.
I'm so thrilled to be back with you here, Kate. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited about talking with you about your music for Deathloop that you wrote as the head composer. It's just amazing.
Thanks so much. Yeah, this one I've been really dying to talk to you about this for a long time. I finished over a year ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
I don't know how you guys do it. Just, you know, keeping all these secrets. It must be really, really hard.
It comes second nature. I think if I ever got like a top secret job in the CIA, it would be second nature. You know, I'm so used to this with the with composing for video games.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it's kind of interesting because, you know, Secret Service and all that, Deathloop is very stealthy and just pulls a lot from, you know, kind of secret spy type stuff. It's made by Arkane Studios in Lyon. And they're just, I don't know what it is about Arkane games. They are so great at really creating a sense of mid-20th century place and time. They did it with Prey, and they're doing it with this one. And it must have been such a fun environment to create the music for.
It really was. And I have to say, I mean, you always have high hopes when you start to work on something and you see the concept art and you start to see early things and you're thinking, wow, yeah, this could be amazing. You know, and quite often things don't live up to your expectations. Deathloop was a case where it exceeded my expectations because I came in really early. I started working on this in January 2020. So even though they were pretty far along, there was plenty to go. And I really didn't have a comprehensive understanding of every little nuance when I started. You know, I was still wondering, what are those floating words in the air mean? This was a new thing. I mean, this isn't a typical kind of game brief you get, you know? So I love that kind of stuff. I always love doing things that are off the beaten path and different and unique. But it also introduces a huge challenge and requires a great deal of not only research, but a lot of faith in the people you're working with.
Yeah, for sure. The story of the game is so interesting because it kind of plays with the whole concept of, you know, death and then respawning for a player, because Colt, this assassin, keeps basically respawning and playing the same day over and over again until he kills all of the assassins that are also trying to kill him. And it's just a fascinating story and a really cool concept.
I was really pleasantly surprised, if not blown away, because I only got a chance to see the beginning of the game when everyone else did. So literally last week, I don't have a PS5 yet. Sony, are you listening? But I do have it on Steam, and I started playing the game with my son, right? And I just wanted him to experience it with me too, because he's now 17. And so we're playing it together. And I have to say, the dialogue between Colt and Juliana in the early part of the game, it is just hilarious. And just to see his reactions, and, well, you don't know what's going on. You experience it through his eyes, and you know, you see yourself getting killed. I don't want to spoil everything, but the dialogue and the banter, it's hilarious because it's like, what is going on? He's like, I was just here and now I'm here. And, you know, I just can't do it justice, but it is really amusing and to play. And man, the scripting and dialogue is amazing in this game.
So. Even just the little asides that he does, like you could pick up ammo and he says, no, I'm good. And it's just...
Yeah, right. That's really incredible. I mean, they thought of every detail. I mean, this is really a rare thing to be a part of. You know, a game at this level where it really excels on every level something can excel on. And I am so grateful and excited to see the world discover this. And even though only PS5 owners and Steam can play it right now, you know, rumor has it that September 14th next year, it's going to have a whole new loop, if you will, a whole new life. It's going to come back again.
I hope that's the case. I don't have a PS5 yet either, so. I was really fascinated in an earlier interview. You were talking about how the initial theme that you wrote seemed okay for those early, you know, early months when you were working on the game. But then later on, you realized that it just wasn't quite right. So what was it lacking, that original theme?
In a word, I'd say the personality. When I first started, you know, I'm a bit blind, right? Because it's a brand new thing. You know, you hear it. It's easy now in hindsight to look back and say, oh, of course, this makes sense and this makes sense. But literally, when you're dropped in this, you don't know what Deathloop is. This whole aesthetic, it sounds very risky. Sounds like, are people really going to like this? You know, you have go through all those things. Anytime you're truly original, it feels like a huge leap of faith. Beyond that, the theme is always one of the first things that I like to do. And I had the least information. The director, the audio director, Michelle, who is amazing, he gave me a 50-page document on the game before I even started. But still, a document is a document, right? It's not playing the game. So he really wanted the music to represent the mysteriousness of Black Reef, the island. So with that in mind, that was his direction. So, you know, imagining things like the old score to Mysterious Island, or, you know, the show Lost, that feeling where it's this desolate, isolated island. And albeit that's very true, as I got months into the game and I started seeing the pacing of it and I started getting a sense of the animated characters and the colorful environment and the tongue-in-cheek nature of it, even though I didn't have a full picture, I had enough to realize, you know what? Something just doesn't feel right. I feel like we need something that is going to catch us more, that's going to be hookier, that's going to be this just thing you want to hear over and over again. And something with some personality and life that can start small, that can be eerie, but can also be very exciting. And, you know, so I just took a very simple idea, and it took a while, you know, to just get those simple ideas. But once I got it, I presented it back to the audio director without even telling him that I was working on this in the background. You know, and at first he's like, oh, thank you so much. But, you know, I don't know. And I'm like, of course, you can't just have a knee-jerk reaction to just change the main theme to the game that the whole team has been hearing. About a few weeks later or whatever, he sat with it. I made my case. And he came back. He says, you know what? I agree. I think this is a better theme for the game. So that was a huge, huge step. And I'm very glad that... you know, he had such an open mind to give that a shot, and it worked out, and that became the foundation for the rest of the score.
Thank you.
because now, I mean, hearing that theme and hearing that music and the way it you know, appears in various guises through the game, I can't imagine anything else. It's just so perfect. And you're right. I mean, it's kind of the way Apple designs things. It's so simple. It can't be anything else. And the theme that you ended up with is just basically three notes. I mean, it's just, that's like, all it is like kind of like the James Bond theme. And so was that one of the inspirations? I know other people have asked you that too.
The feeling of James Bond was definitely one of the inspirations. But James Bond as a whole was not really the average, you know, center identity of the music for me. It certainly had an influence in some areas, and you know, the theme is going to have a little bit of that just because of that low guitar sound and the nature of those half steps, you know, that kind of does fall in line stylistically with, you know, you have those half notes. You know, those kind of intervals. Yeah, I get it. But I wasn't like, oh, I want to goo another James Bond theme. That was not
where
it was in my head.
Yeah, you kind of can't do that. So
Yeah, I didn't do that. It was a combination of things. It was a 60s aesthetic with a mystery, and really the first thing was the chord progression. The chord progression is what defined those notes for me. And after I had that chord progression, I'm like, this feels right. Then the notes took shape.
Well, so like, what was the ripple effect with all, you know, reworking everything? Because I know you've told me, and other composers have too, that the theme is kind of the seed that grows the soundtrack.
That's
so
right.
How much like retrofitting did you have to do?
Well, not too much, because keep in mind, I didn't want to get too far along until I felt like this theme was a grand slam. So I will say that some of the music in the game, like the Upper City exploration section, the soft section, that actually was when I had the old theme in place. And there are a few remnants of the original theme actually in that section of music in the Upper City. It's the slow-paced, mysterious section of that part of the map that actually has remnants of the original theme in it, but not enough to say, oh, there's a theme. So I didn't get past that. It's funny because then the fight section has the new theme. So, you know, it was too good to not. I didn't want to throw that away, and I didn't need to because it wasn't like just repeating the theme. So there wasn't too much rework.
Well, that's awesome. I loved with the musical research that you did. You said that one of the things was the 1960s Batman TV series, and I love that because it's just so campy and it's like super aware. And so what did you take away from that music to use in your soundtrack?
Was referring to one of the visionaries, one of the targets that you have to kill along the way. I don't want to spoil which one it is, but when I saw the description of the character, and he did call attention to some reference music referring to some old Spider-Man and a Batman series, I'm like, oh, that kind of sound. So, you know, I just remember the bam, 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 you know, when he's punching people out and, you know, like every time the bat symbol spins into the distance, you know, that was ingrained into my head as a little kid watching that after school. So kind of thanks to the miracle of YouTube, kind of going back and rewatching some of those series and, you know, bringing some of that color and those chords back in, that was a blast. That really was so much fun. And then I handed it off once I set the foundation together. Then I handed it off to my dear friend Philippe Sace, legendary jazz musician, to put some of his magic. I'm like, okay, so here you go. What can you do with this? And then he just starts going, you know, unbelievable. So yeah, Nelson Riddle was definitely a big influence in that particular track.
Oh, that's hysterical.
Yeah, I was just laughing as I was doing that track.
So how did you build out kind of the instrumentation then? I mean, what instruments did you think were really kind of key to sort of vaguely reference that area or that era, but not, you know, sound like an old record from the 60s?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time on that night, and I remember it vividly, especially because I just relived it as I'm putting together a new masterclass about using the music of Deathloop and how it was done. And so I retraced all of my steps, and I forgot how much time I put into those sounds. So basically what I did is, you know, after I went through, I don't know, close to 100 references of just research and listening, and then I started trying to figure out, okay, what works, what doesn't, what kinds of sounds work, what doesn't, and trying to figure out ingredients that would work in a new soup, so to speak, in a new dish that I had to cook up, trying to define who's in the band, so to speak. And so it was a lot of trial and error. I'm like, okay, I love this tremolo Rhodes that Led Zeppelin uses. I'd go in and try to recreate that sound, because that's a lot of my background too, is just programming sounds and, you know, how to listen and match something exactly. Back going back to high school and going back to when I was on tour with Bobby Brown, that was my job. I had to listen to the record and reproduce the sounds on synthesizer. So doing that was a blast. So I'm like, okay, I like this, and I like a little of this, and maybe a touch of this, and I like that kind of drum, and I like this kind of bass, and I love this. So I just started making my own combination, my own band of lots and lots of sounds that I liked, and then seeing what I could do with them. So that's really how it all started.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before, but I'm really curious if you used any sort of period instruments, you know, like farfises or that kind of thing, or were you able to find samples that were close enough and then you could work with them so that you got the sound that you wanted?
Yes. Well, when we're talking about, you're saying period instruments, you probably mean a physical, real thing.
Yeah, that's
right?
What I was thinking about, yeah.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, the only physical, real things that showed up on the score was vibraphone. So that was definitely real. I have one and Philippe has one. Philippe has a real Rhodes. He has a Wurlitzer. He has a clavinet. So some of those were real. Let's see. What else? A lot of the guitars were real, but not all of them, believe it or not. You know, but that I wouldn't call that a period instrument. However, that being said, some of the guitarists I work with really had some of the period amps and things like that. So I really try to replicate as close as I can. Now, that being said, the quality of the samples, and I won't even just say samples now, because it's a lot of times we have virtual instruments. So I have virtualized instruments of clavinets and B3s and things that actually recreate the sound. They don't just sample it. So I had everything pretty much. I was able to do period instruments, you know, even if some of them were computer based, including the effects too. Because I realized, okay, there were no Lexicon 480 reverbs back in the late 60s and 70s. So I stuck with things that they had. I stuck with, you know, whether it be, you know, spring reverbs or plates or stuff like that. So I really tried to take a purist approach as much as possible. And then after that, I took some creative liberties, you know, to just round it out and give it a little modern aesthetic to just make it sound satisfying to listen to.
Well, and that totally works because although, you know, the look of Deathloop is sort of this vaguely mid-century, late 60s, early 70s, it's not authentic. So must have given you a little wiggle room to kind
of... It's a romanticized, glorified version. And that's kind of what the music is, too. It's me using... It's like I found all these instruments in current time, but I wanted to kind of use them in the score. Like, oh, what can I do with this stuff? So, you know, I mean, look, I took tons of nods to all kinds of my, you know, musical heroes from back then. Everything from Led Zeppelin to The Doors to Jimi Hendrix to, you name it. There's so many groups and artists and things that I couldn't help but just imagine in my mind. It's part of who I am. It's part of my musical DNA, right? I mean, we pull from all of our experience, so... but yeah, it was done with a modern aesthetic. I mean, my personality is still in there. I can't help it.
Well, I would hope so. I mean,
right?
I mean, I know you have to serve the game, but you also want to sound, you know, have a sound you're proud of and something that kind of sounds like you.
So, right. Yeah. You know, at the end of the day, you're the artist and so it's going to come through you. So I'm channeling all of that stuff, but it's through my lens.
Yeah. I'm kind of picturing all of them on one gigantic stage. How right. cool that yeah. would all be. Yeah.
That's a great visual. And for me, I think that's the way it is in my brain. You know, it is just one gigantic stage of my musical experiences throughout life. And it's laughable how varied it is. You know, it truly is.
Wow.
Yeah.
One of the things that is so interesting about the gameplay is it makes a feature of looping. And, you know, looping in music, it comes with the territory for writing game music, but not necessarily with a game mechanic. And so what were some of the things that you did to keep it varied so that as Colt is, you know, reliving this day over and over again, the music isn't super repetitive?
Yeah, well, I'm glad you're saying that because, I mean, that was an obvious concern of mine. I mean, I always was like, okay, is this going to get tiresome? Is this going to get tiresome? I was aware of that from day one. So, you know, first and foremost, that's why I came up with I found a chord progression and with a melody that I could hear for a long, long time and not get sick of it. Okay, so that's step one. Step two is to approach it in lots of different ways. You do lots of different arrangements of it. Use lots of different instruments and colors and approaches and textures. So, you know, and I could do, you know, there's so many in there and I can do many more. So that was another way just to kind of approach it differently. And lastly, wherever I could, break away from it, you know, break away. I mean, every piece of music is not the theme, although it is a large part of it. I mean, all the menus, of course, the main themes, and you hear it in some of the actual map music, and you hear the melody come in many different places with some of the targets and visionaries and areas, but it also breaks away. So it's nice because it's a nice balance. So you have it, you have enough of it, but not to get sick of it. But it also comes in ways that, you know, some people might not recognize. Like I'll bring in three notes that are evocative of the theme, but are not the theme. You know, a different mode or a different, you know, just completely different intervals, but it still has that three note thing. So I think you'll feel that as you either play the game or listen to the score or both.
Well, it helps that Colt, each time he comes back, he knows a little bit more. And so he can go and visit different areas. And then there's the combat, too. And
yes.
What did you enjoy about writing the combat music? Because it's just incredible.
Oh, man. Well, you know, the combat music for me, I'll be honest, it's always harder for me. You know, combat music is more challenging. Because, well, maybe because of many reasons, but one of the things is you're talking about generally high energy music that can't compete with the sound effects and everything else going on. So that's one challenge right away. How do you make an arrangement that sits well so you can enjoy it and hear it, but doesn't get in the way? That's always a challenge. I don't care what game or style you're doing. The other challenge was that when I was doing a lot of my research, it was not really painfully obvious of what kind of late 60s music had the right kind of high energy and the right kind of aggression. I mean, really, go through, you know, go on wherever, Spotify or Apple Music, and start listening to late 60s music. Not, there's not a lot of aggressive, mean, tough-sounding stuff.
Yeah, even in the Bond films. I'm thinking about it now. You know, some of those fights in, like, Goldfinger or whatever.
Yeah, it's a little campy. I mean, it's Austin Powers. That's the late 60s. That's more common. So, you know, finding riffs that I'm like, I had to kind of dig around and remind myself of some of that stuff. So, you know, things like, yes, Roundabout, you know, or Jimi Hendrix, Purple Haze, or some of the other... You know, there's some other Led Zeppelin tracks and what have you. I mean, those are some of the few places where I was able to find period music that had the right attitude or had the right aggression that would give me a good foundation to build from.
We'll be right back.
So that was probably the most challenging part. And then finding a way, okay, once I had that riff and that hook and that vibe, okay, now how do I bring that band back in, you know, and make it sound cohesive? So it's the same recipe. It's the same aesthetic that makes it Deathloop. You know, my goal with everything I do is to make it instantly identifiable, that if you have your eyes closed, within 3 seconds, you know what score it is. And that's hard to do. It is.
Well, what were some of the things that you would say make this score unique in ways that, you know, so it is completely identifiable?
Perhaps an unconventional blend, maybe an unconventional treatment of certain instruments. Just thinking offhand, like, I loved using the clavinet on this. And because I'm a keyboard player, I'm always looking for ways to have a keyboard instrument give me enough freedom to sound like a guitarist. You know, to do something that sounds tough. You know, I mean, usually guitars have that benefit. You know, you can just throw it in an amp, turn it up to 11, start doing some keys, and now you're immediately tough. Keyboardists can't do that as easily. But when I found certain sounds and things that I was able to do to the clavinets and the B3s and the Rhodes and the Wurlitzers, those sounds and tones became like a part of the signature. And also some of the effects. I mean, a good amount of it is dreamy, ambient kind of stuff. So you hear these like distorted keyboards going through these soupy effects, and you know, there's also tone wobbling throughout the score a lot. There's a very subtle pitch modulation throughout a lot of the music in there that you don't realize it, but it just helps give it an old gleam, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know?
Kind of like when you've left your record out in the sun a little too
long.
Yeah,
warped a little bit. It has a little warp to it, just a little bit, which I felt was also appropriate for this score, because something's off.
Yeah.
Something's not quite right. This isn't natural. So, you know, I had a lot of fun creating sounds and tones and a certain effect that the whole score kind of sounds like. It's kind of like when you watch certain movies, you know, how they have like a certain color cast on it. I think that is, I did that a bit with the music. There's a certain color cast to the music that also makes it unique.
Yeah, well, and it goes with the palette that they chose for the game too, because that's super unified too. So no matter where you are in one of the maps, you know that you're on the island.
Yeah.
So yeah.
That's right. Yeah. You're in Black Reef.
Well, so what were some of the challenges about like creating a musical signature for the different areas, like the Upper City or the Wharf? Did you have to really think about that too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the difficulties when it comes to areas like this is how to differentiate them musically. And, you know, often that's not that difficult in games, particularly when the environments are very, very different. You know, when you're like, okay, well, here's Water World and here's the desert. And, you know, like a Mario game, right? You can have all these very different looking areas. Here's the garden, you know. In Black Reef, yeah, there's a difference between the areas, but it's not like a huge difference. You know, if you look at the snapshots, it's not like, oh my God, where's this? You can kind of tell they all belong. So trying to use instruments without any kind of environmental elements in them to differentiate those areas in a way that they wanted to probably was a big part of the challenge.
Yeah, I'll bet. Well, like for the Wharf, what did you give? How did you build that signature sound?
Yeah, so with the Wharf, I think that was one of the areas that I wanted it to be kind of hazy, you know, kind of like you're close to the water and it's kind of foggy and it's low, dark, perhaps not very dreary looking. So that probably informed the music quite a bit, especially in the exploration phases. Also, where that music comes back in four different variations. Okay, keep in mind, right, you go through the game and every area, you can go through that area four different times of the day. And so, you know, whether it's the wharf or the upper city, those areas you get to revisit. And it was in the exploration music that those variations took place.
Wow, that's so fascinating. So
that was also part of it.
Yeah, yeah. That's really fascinating because I'm sure it gave you a lot of, you know, opportunities to kind of change things up and think about it. And so rather
so it's like, okay, so now we're at the wharf at midnight. What does that sound like? Okay, now we're in the wharf in the afternoon. What does that sound like? You know, now we're at the wharf in the evening, but you know, you want to give a sense that there's more liveliness because the party's happening and all that kind of stuff, you know. And, you know, I hear this in the words and stuff, but I don't get a chance to see the party or really to understand. But, you know, I'm understanding there's this carnival atmosphere and the island kind of wakes up. So trying to communicate this difference in energy and tone and mood in four different ways in all these different areas. But that would sound consistent but fresh. all part of this unique challenge in scoring Deathloop and, you know, games in general. That's really what makes it different than anything else.
Yeah, for sure. You know, you touched on the dialogue, the banter between Juliana and Colt, and I noticed it too. And then there's all these odd little comments that you hear on the PA system. It sort of reminded me of Borderlands in a way, because it's got that kind of really dark humor. And did you feel at all like your music had to also reflect that humor, or was it just better to keep the music being kind of a straight man?
Well, you know what? That's an important question, and I want to talk about that with being the straight man, but I do want to say that I didn't hear any of this banter when I was doing the game. None of it. I mean, the only time I heard talking was in some of the, you know, I think some of the cutscenes that I got later on toward the end. So I really didn't get a chance to hear the banter, and I'm just so relieved that, oh my God, it works. It works with the music. The music did capture that personality, and that's the personality that I kind of had a sense of. And what kind of made me start to change direction earlier on with that theme. But the first part of your question was very important. Regarding the straight man point, that is really perceptive of you. And I think it's something that when it comes to music, you have to understand that sometimes the effect is achieved by the music not following along exactly with the humor, right? So a perfect example of this, I think, would be Henry Mancini, like Pink Panther, right? I mean, yes, some of the music is dun, 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 ba, ba, bum, da, 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 da. Yeah, it has lightheartedness to it. But I mean, the music in general is serious. Doesn't mean it's depressing, but it's really legit, serious, beautiful music that you can just listen to and like, oh my God, that's gorgeous and I love it. But when you put that along with Inspector Clouseau, and just, you know, that because he's taking himself seriously and we're all laughing at him, the effect is just like nothing else, right? So I guess it becomes greater than the sum of its parts. And the music, I think, does play the straight man, but it doesn't realize that it's actually being a little funny.
Wow. That's very,
you know,
subtle,
kind of,
yeah.
Like, you know, I mean, look, think of it. Even the most extreme example of that is, you know, the Nelson Riddle stuff with Batman. I mean, that wasn't funny music. I mean, that was the music of the day, that swing jazz. You know, that would be so campy and it would be a joke now. But it was serious. So there's nothing in the music that's intended to be funny, but what's intended to match the personality of the game and enhance it is the effect that the music plays in the context of the game.
Well, in a way, that's perfect, because it gives those lines a chance to land, and it's not telling you, hey, that was a joke, did you get it?
Right, that's right, that's right. And that's why I'm really so excited, because, again, this was kind of new to me. When I started hearing the dialogue, I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. This has got to win some awards for dialogue, because this is amazing. I'm really enjoying it. I mean, it's better than most, you know, TV series, as far as I'm concerned, as far as the dialogue and stuff like that. It was really hilarious.
Yeah, it is. And the thing that struck me is, you know, as a player, you spend a lot of time like building Colt's skill tree and swapping out weapons and upgrading stuff and that kind of thing. And so the music in these menus while you're doing that is really important, because it's like your only friend while you're doing all of this stuff. And in a way, you're kind of not in the game world at that point. So what are some of the things you think about when you're writing music for the menus?
Well, I'm thinking about setting the stage and building some anticipation of the experience. And fortunately, because of the kind of theme the main theme is, it gave us a lot of flexibility to work with it and approach it in different ways. And fortunately, after that new theme took place, it all made sense, because with Michelle's documentation, and you know, he showed me a graphic map of the menus, like, okay, here's, you have the splash screen, and then you have four different periods of music, so it's the same music but done in four different ways to match four different times of day, and then you have the cult variation, and then you have the Juliana variation. Fortunately, I can do all that with the same theme and just rearrange it in different ways, just approach it, just the instrumentation, you know. So for the Juliana version, I bring in the female vocal of Aralee Brighton, you know, and then for the cult variation, I focus on the low guitar, bong, 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 you know, that's his instrument. And, you know, for the morning, I bring in those little tremolo strings, so it sounds like the sunrise, you know. And, you know, for the evening, I bring in like the jamming beat and the jamming bass line, because that's the party. So it gave me a chance to really expand the theme even more, you know, because it's fun, but it goes by, you know, three something minutes. So having a chance to spend, I don't know, I forgot whether it was a minute or 6 or 2 minutes on each section, that was great. It's like, of course, I could do this all day.
Yeah. Wow. That's so cool. Talked a little bit about the target that was a perfect fit for the music that you sort of borrowed from Batman. But are there any others that you can talk about, you know, without spoilers, that you could let us know how you built their kind of musical identity?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And what made this really fun is that in the document that I received, Michelle took the time to really paint the character, his personality. So I remember this first one I did, Alexis Dorsey. This is literally the way he described it. Ready? An outspoken man-child with an inflated ego.
Thank you.
Yeah, so the idea here is that he gives me all these fun descriptions of characters with all their quirky personalities and say, okay, this guy's a young billionaire and financial investor and, you know, he's fond of sugar with candy dispensers, you know, and soda machines lining the wall of his home. I mean, that's wonderful because for me, that just brings him to life. I can't play the game, but hearing that is like, it's like reading a book. You can imagine the character in your mind. And then he suggests that maybe we have a little fun with a jazz band. So with that, I'm like, okay, this is great. Let's make it like really arrogant sounding, very ritzy and highbrow. And so I called upon a wonderful saxophonist, David Mann, who's quite accomplished. I remember him from the 90s. And then Philippe Sace, of course. I'm like, okay, ready, Philippe? Have a little fun with your sophisticated lounge. You know, so some of the performances in there just really like exaggerated those personalities. I remember another fun one was, who was it? Yeah, like Wenji Evans. So she's all into supernatural phenomenon and stuff like that, and has like involved with the military and military time machines and whatever. So, you know, I'm like, okay, definitely the theremin and, you know, the timpanis to give it that militant feel and, you know, all of that. So each character had a distinctive personality. Harriet Morse was the one that was very much into like this cult thing, very spiritual, but her version of spirituality is very like cultish and, you know, like old, scary, dark kind of stuff. So, you know, I put in like some really warped Gregorian chanting stuff and like a very distant church bell in the background, Kong, and you know, like this kind of cult worshiping stuff. So I had to look at all of those characters and find ways to treat them that wouldn't really overlap. That was the thing. So that was why I wanted to make sure that they were exaggerated and very clear yet distinctly different.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds like it must have been just a total blast to come up with.
Yeah.
That.
You know, I mean, each one is a challenge. It's like, oh no, you know, is this going to be a tough one? Is this, how am I going to do this one? But, you know, eventually we figured it out. You know, eventually we brought it in there and based on the descriptions and the personalities and a little experimentation here and there, it worked out. So I think people will enjoy it.
That's so cool. I'm just wondering, you know, if there were some other highlights about working on this project that we haven't covered yet.
Oh my gosh. I was working on this for about 6 months. I think it was about 6 months. It started in January 2020 and I was wrapping up in June of 2020. So that was one of the things, which is kind of a slow paced, or a very comfortable pace, you know, because a lot was still going on in the game development. So it wasn't a frantic period by any means. And one of the things with Deathloop is that as I was doing this, I decided that I would turn this into a course for some future date. And so over a year later, that's one of the things that I'm just putting the finishing touches on now. So for those who are really deep into this and interested in doing this professionally, that is something that will be available soon.
That's really cool. And your site, the courses you're offering, the masterclasses are so interesting. And so people can see them and sign up on your website, right?
Yes. It's going to be tomsalta.com/masterclass. And currently there is Game Music Essentials, and that one I put together. I think we've even talked about this before. That was a, you know, very condensed crash course for anyone who's interested in games, and it's like a, you know, kind of looks at the entire process. Whereas Deathloop goes way deep into detail, and it really is like holding your hand through how to do this from beginning to end, from conception to delivery. So there's a lot to offer, and your listeners will be offering them a code. So however you want to share that with some of your listeners, we'll give you a unique code for a limited time for a discount if anyone does want to go and check it out.
Oh, that's so awesome. That'll be on my website, respawnshow.com. It'll be in the SoundCloud, Music Respawn SoundCloud, and at WSHU too. And Tom, it's been just so fascinating to talk with you about this, and I really appreciate your time, and congratulations. The soundtrack is just incredible.
Thanks so much, Kate. I always enjoy our conversations. It was a pleasure to be here.